We began looking at this phrase, a Christian church for the quantum era. It actually started before that at our, the week before that at our community meeting in late January. Michelle was using the image of Russian nesting dolls, and she said that the largest doll defines the shape of all the dolls that are going to come after that. And as we've been thinking about how to focus our energies and our efforts at becoming the healthiest community that we can be, we wanted to say, where do all of our efforts, what shapes all of our efforts? And as we begin thinking about what would be a way of thinking about why we're here and what we're doing that would help shape that, and this is the phrase that we came up with, a Christian church for the quantum era. But that's only six words. And several of those words require a great deal of unpacking. In fact, some of them were chosen because they're purposely vague so that we don't have a whole bunch of preconceived idea of what these words mean so that we can help be the defining force behind those words and not muddy things up with things that have to be unlearned. What does quantum era mean? And why does it matter if we're in the Enlightenment era or the quantum era? Isn't the Christian message transcendent and timeless? So we're doing several lessons this year clustered around unpacking this shaping context, this Russian nesting doll for our community. What does it mean to be a Christian church for the quantum era? We began 2 weeks ago by acknowledging the liability we face when we use the word Christian. That's a sketchy word these days. It doesn't carry the connotation of goodness that it once did. I was talking with my wife recently, and she was saying to someone had used the word Christian in defining their business, and she said it just made me less trusting of them because I've had experiences with Christian business people, and that's when I've been ripped off. So it doesn't carry the connotation of goodness that it once did. It's been a tarnished word. And I'm not without sympathy for those who think that the word is too tarnished to resurrect. I don't agree for reasons that I'm going to lay out in these lessons, but I really do understand the perspective. In fact, it was my perspective when I was in my 20s. One of the most fun things that happens in my life these days is when I drive up to Asheville and I have lunch with my son, Daniel. This is Daniel, and those of you who haven't seen his new fiance, that's his fiance. And so when I drive up there, we talk. And usually about something of the spiritual journey. He's very keen to have those kinds of discussions. Well, he was until he started falling in love, and then he wanted to have those kinds of discussions. But now, my son is an Enneagram 9, and 9s tend to resist anyone exercising power over them. And I somehow intuited that early on, which was really a tough thing for an 8 to intuit because, my Lord, I'm in my own house and I can't use my power with my son. And so, but I somehow figured that out. And the result of figuring that out, even without the Enneagram framework to be able to help me do it, I developed a pretty good relationship with him for talking about things that often are hard to talk about between fathers and sons. And one of them is the spiritual journey. And just as an aside, if you're a minister and you want to talk to your kids about spirituality, you're just screwed. It's just not going to happen. So this was one of the best things that's ever happened in my life. So, but there is a notable point of disagreement between the two of us. He's in the camp that is not buying the word Christian. He thinks the word has too much liability associated with it to be even redeemable. So, of course, he's wrong and I'm right, which will become clear in this lesson. But hey, he can be forgiven his youthful ignorance. That's going to go over well, and I'm going to send him the link to this lesson to hear it. So if you would, go ahead and say, hello, Daniel.
Hello, Daniel.
But I really do understand those who can't use the word Christian or Christianity anymore. But if that's you, I would ask you to suspend judgment for just a little bit, because I have this year of lessons really designed to help us rethink the concept. We began 2 weeks ago before our guest speaker this way. Western society is in the throes of another Renaissance, and the church is in the throes of another Reformation. As a culture, our view of the universe is rapidly changing, and this is requiring us to update all sectors of our society, politics and economics and social structures and religion. And Anytime you have to update, that is change. And change is demanding and change is difficult, and it doesn't always happen easily. I was speaking with a young man yesterday who is rethinking his own faith, and like many young people, he was discouraged at the church's entrenched resistance to the change that is set before us. And so I gave him a little bit of perspective from an old guy, and I said, conservatives are conservative because they have something to conserve. That's the nature of the word. Conservatives preserve the tradition. Conservatives preserve the tried and true ways. Conservatives defend the hard-won victories of the past. And when they do that, they act like ballast in a ship, holding the old wisdom for the new generation in the midst of all the kinds of storms that come. They keep the boat afloat in turbulent times, and they preserve the ways that have worked, and they preserve the truths that have worked, and they preserve the triumphs of the past. And the church is a conservative institution. It really is, and for good reason. The church has seen wonderful times, has seen triumphant insights, has experienced transformative wisdom, some things that are so rich and worthy of preservation. For the last 500 years, things have gone just fabulously. We've done wonderful things in people's lives. We have found and offered profound meaning. We have found and offered deep protection. We have found and we have offered thoughtful, insightful understanding. The church offered great benefit to those inside its walls and gave the gift of social lift and healing to those outside the walls. And when Christians find our way, ours is a heritage that is worth conserving. The problem is that every so often in history, at certain times, the ballast giving, wisdom preserving benefit that conservation, conserving the old ways, has given us, it actually begins to work against us. Sometimes in history are times for change, and conserving during those times works against us. But it's really difficult to know when to flip the switch. How do you know when this thing that has worked so well, that it is an important role, is no longer the time for, and it's no longer the place for, and so, as we said last time, the ability to move when it's time to move is not always easy to see, but that too is embedded in our tradition. The ability to move when it's time to move is also part of the word Christian. It is also part of this, our heritage. Now, of course, some take on the role of resisting change when it's time to change. Of course they do. It's a very deeply embedded role, and it's a strong part of our habits. But some also embrace change when it's time to embrace change. And the changers eventually prevail when the moment in history calls for it. That's always been the way that it goes. And this time in which we live, when change is being required of us, this will be no exception. Now again, some will resist the change that is required, and again, for very good reasons. But we will find our way again. We always have, and we will again. So that's a quick synopsis of what I said 2 weeks ago and part of why I contend for the word Christian. A tradition is a tradition because it has stood the test of time. It's still around after 100 years and after 1,000 years and after 2,000 or 5,000 years. And standing the test of time means that there is built right into the system a self-corrective dynamic. And we have one. And so, when we deviate from the way and the truth and the life, the ability to self-correct is also a rich part of the Christian heritage. So I said a couple of weeks ago, hang on, folks. Good times are before us as Christian people because we have been pushed to the fringes of power. And we do so much better when we're out of the power position. That's when we find the way and the truth and the life. Today, I want to talk about another reason I contend for the word Christian, If you and I have been to coffee together sometime, you might have seen me pull out a scratch paper and do some circles and drawings on this page, because it goes to what we mean when we say the word Christian, and it goes to why we would stay within the Christian tradition as opposed to leaving it. You'll recall two weeks ago I said that religion becomes the house that spirituality lives in. And when the house gets toxic, when it's rat infested or has radon, spirituality has to move out of the house. And that's what we're experiencing in our time, that spirituality is having to move out of the house of religion. The problem with moving out of the house, well, the good part is you don't only no longer have rats and radon. That's a good thing. But the problem is you are now without a house. You are homeless. And there is something about being on our own on the spiritual journey that has a wandering element, that if we could have a healthy house, that would be so much more conducive to our own spirituality. And so as we are thinking about this rebuilding of the tradition, the restorative work before us in our tradition, I want to talk about these things. Let me start this way. If you're a good Christian and you engage in conversation with a good Buddhist, the Buddhist will say something like this: don't become a Buddhist, become the best Christian that you can be. But most Christians, on the other hand, in that conversation will have to say this: for you to continue on the spiritual journey, good Buddhist friend, you must now stop being Buddhist and become Christian. And that's just kind of the way that conversation goes. And the fact that that conversation takes place rubs a lot of people the wrong way. A lot of people feel very uncomfortable with that conversation. But what else is the Christian to do? Because the central figure of our faith, Jesus, said these words: I am the way, the truth, and the life, and nobody comes to God except through me. And so the good Christian thinks that he or she has to say to the Buddhist that you have to become part of this tradition in order for you to come to God. You have to be part of my religion in order for you to come to God. Now, as we've mentioned, that framework worked really well for 500 years when we lived in the Newtonian world, because if you remember what I said, F equals MA implies that F is not equal to 2 times MA. And so we had basically a universe for the last 500 words in which if A is true, well, then not A is not true. That's the basic framework of reality that we lived in. We didn't say those words out loud, but that's just kind of the gut instinct we carried around in the way that we lived. If A is true, well, then not A is not true. And when Newton was king, that just made all kinds of sense in the world. But now Einstein has given us a new world in which my clock is over here going tick, tick, tick. Yours moving away is going tick, tick, tick. And mine is right and yours is right. And so truth is depending on where you're standing when you experience. And all of a sudden we have this new universe in which if A is true, well, not A is also true. How did that happen? And so now we live in this different framework, this different reality. And so when the Christian says Christianity is A, true, and Buddhism is not A, therefore Buddhism is not true, millennial kids that were born in the 90s and into the 2000s, cock their heads and they say, wait a minute, it doesn't even matter what you're talking about. It doesn't matter that you're talking about religion. You have just said something about the universe that isn't the way the universe works. The universe isn't A is true, not A is not true. And so they get jangled and they say, well, hey, what's going on here? We can't hear that. It's like you're saying up is down and in is out. It just isn't that way. It doesn't work that way. So Christians, having this conversation that we've been having for 500 years, start getting pushback. Pushback we weren't used to. And instead of going back into our heritage and double-checking, we've tended to entrench and to push back harder. And we've tended to get louder. And we've tended to turn up the volume. We've tended to get a little more shrill. We've tended to use different kinds of language, thinking this way they'll really get it. This way they'll understand it. And it's not going very well for us. And so the question is, what does it mean when Jesus says, I am the way, the truth, and the life, and no one comes unto the Father but by me? Is that the way that we tell that story? Is that what Jesus meant? Or is that a function of the message of Jesus being translated into the Roman Empire context? And we've got a whole year of lessons to discuss that question. But let me begin with Buddhism. So we're going to start on ground that feels pretty secure to many Christians, and it is this. Are you ready? Buddhists are weird and crazy. Here, we're Christian people. We feel really comfortable with that. Buddhists are weird and crazy. I know because I lived with Buddhists for a year, and they do all kinds of strange and weird stuff. They feed dead people, for crying out loud. They really do. And then after they've left the food out on their doorstep to feed the dead people, and the dead people don't come and get it, they go ahead and they eat the food anyway, because since the ancestors ate the spirit food, we don't want to let the food go to waste, and so they eat the food, and it's just weird. And then there's the firecrackers and there's evil spirits, and it's all just weird. But wait, those Christian people, they are weird. They are strange and weird. They're cannibals, for goodness sakes. They eat the body and they drink the blood, and they do it every week. And then they drown their kids in order to get the sin out. They're just, it's all very, very weird. And so, when you look at this from an organized religion perspective, the Buddhists and the Christians practice their faith in such wildly different institutional ways, they couldn't be further from one another, as far as they can get from one another. So, to one, the other just seems completely weird and strange. But there is something observable that happens. It's a thing. It's a real thing. You can find it in the writings of both the Christian and the Buddhist. You can hear it when they speak. This thing really happens. And that is, when the Buddhist moves to the center of his or her religion, and when the Christian moves to the center of his or her religion, they find the contemplative center. And when they do, they find what we're going to unpack in the next weeks this term, the perennial tradition. And what they find is a way of talking about God, and a way of talking about salvation, and a way of talking about the spiritual journey that sounds so much like each other. What you find is that the contemplative Christian is more different from the institutional Christian than the contemplative Christian is different from the contemplative Buddhist. And what you find is that there is great similarity in the way that they understand the spiritual life and the spiritual reality. When people move to the contemplative center of their tradition, they begin to step back from the institutional mandates that their own respective traditions have generated and created. And they begin to seek and they begin to experience something different than the regulatory institutional way of doing church or doing temple, I would guess. And what they look for in its place is direct encounter with something that is bigger than an institution. We use the word spirituality to talk about this. It's the quest for the direct encounter with the divine. Direct encounter with a reality that is beyond reality. Direct encounter with a truth that is beyond truth. And at the center of the Christian faith and at the center of the Buddhist faith is a place where people start talking about experiencing that reality beyond reality. They talk about experiencing that truth beyond truth. And so, when that happens, doctrines stop being the point. Religious rituals stop being the point. Following religious rules stops being the point. Belonging to a group and defining our identity by saying, I am one of these people, stops being the point. And instead, the point becomes connecting to divine reality. Christians and Buddhists who move to the center begin to speak of a divine reality that is underneath and before and behind and above and below everything that is. A reality that is intrinsically part of everything that is. A reality that is inherently in and of everything that is. And these people of direct encounter, these contemplatives, these mystics, they report that while the human soul cannot contain the divine reality, can't hold it in our minds, nevertheless, we can experience it. And we can be deeply moved by it and experience it. We do. In these traditions, we experience this reality. And when we do, we have to try and talk about it. And our words are inadequate because it's a reality beyond reality. Ineffable. Remember that word? It is bigger than we can contain. And so we struggle. We struggle to try and contain an experience in a word or in a thought. And the crazy thing that happens is when we do, we begin to speak a language that sounds very much like one another. So, if you look at the language that is used by the contemplative Christian and the contemplative Buddhist, you find that they're using the same kinds of words and the same kinds of metaphors and the same kinds of images to stumble over trying to talk about God. Or the thing that most threw me was when I first read this, I was reading a Buddhist talk about salvation, and I thought, my Lord, that's just how the Christian mystics talk about salvation. It's the same idea that they're talking about being saved. I thought being saved was a uniquely Christian idea, and here the Buddha is talking about being saved the same way we talk about being saved. They talk about the soul's life and the spiritual journey, and there you can read them. The same images of God in the 16th century Christian monk and the 20th century Buddhist writer. And that's true of contemplative Christians and contemplative Buddhists and Sufi Muslims and Kabbalah Jews and mystical Hindus. When people of these religions move past the institutional practices, the institutional identifications, they begin sounding just like each other. They use the same words. They speak the same kinds of insights, and they speak of the same kinds of experiences. The same kinds of priorities overtake them. The same values inform their energies and inform their efforts. This thing happens. And it's been happening for a long, long time. We just didn't know it. But in 1965, the U.S. Congress passed an immigration reform act that all of a sudden changed the makeup of our culture. So whereas we had had 6% Asians in our society, or in our immigration, we moved to 35% immigration after 1965. And all of a sudden, we started hearing about this thing that we hadn't been hearing about before, because it was just as likely that a Buddhist and a Hindu would live in our neighborhood as a Christian, or that a Buddhist would work in our office, or would live in our neighborhood, or be on the PTA together. And so all of a sudden, we started to hear about things that we hadn't heard about before. Each one of our traditions told the stories of those that we venerate in our traditions, the mystics, the contemplatives, the saints, and sure enough, they sound just like each other. And now, some folks are looking up and saying, hey, what's going on here that we sound so much like each other? Now, some folks put their heads in the sand and pretended it wasn't happening, and they could be forgiven for that because, goodness sakes, Peter had the same reaction when non-Jewish people began to have the same kinds of experiences in Christ that Christian people had had. He didn't know what to do with that because it's a very tough idea to swallow that the world that we live in is bigger than the world that we grew up in. So it's very difficult, and we can understand why we would have avoided that, seeing this thing. But there it is, and pretty soon the word got out. And people begin to ask the question why there should be any religion at all. John Lennon asked us to imagine a world with no religion too. If all the faiths take us to the same place, why be a religion at all? And that's kind of been the path that many people have taken. That's what many have decided is a good path. They have decided to take the no tradition tradition and basically to stay on the outside of any one of the traditions and not choose any one. Well, that's kind of a way of approaching religion that makes sense in a consumerist society because we're used to shopping. And so, hey, I like this Judeo-Christian idea of social justice, so I'll take some of that. And I like this Buddhist idea of karma, so I'll take some of that. And I like the Taoist idea of yin and yang. It helps me get perspective on opposing forces, so I'll have a dash of that. And as good consumerists, we were primed and ready to shop for a bit of this and for a bit of that. The word syncretism is what's often used to talk about that. And so many have chosen to follow the no tradition tradition. have decided to take the no tradition path. The problem with this is that there is something of great value embedded in a tradition. Remember what I said a moment ago. A tradition is a tradition because it has stood the test of time. There are a set of interlocking dynamics inside of traditions that help us arrive at the contemplative center, that help us get to this place of direct encounter with the divine. Part of the dynamic that a tradition has built into it is struggle. It's kind of tough to sell struggle in a consumerist society. It's kind of tough to sell the idea that this is good for us, but let me explain for a moment. To attain to this direct encounter center, one must struggle, and often one must struggle against one's own tradition. Here's an academic book. You don't have to read it, but if you wanted to be like a star pupil, you would get this book. It's called Stages of Faith, and it's written by a guy named James Fowler. And what he does is he makes it very clear the stages we go through as we are pursuing a faith journey. And you can read that book, Stages of Faith, or the popular version, which is called The Critical Journey, which is out of print, but you can still get it on Amazon. And what they'll say basically is there comes a time after you've grown up in your tradition, after you've been loyal to your tradition, after you've been committed to your tradition, where now the most growing thing you can do is begin to fight your tradition. And you have to fight your tradition in order to move on to owning and your own experience of God, your own experience of the divine center. And you have to fight your tradition. And so that's embedded right into the growth process we go through. At some point, if we want to move into the deeper dimensions of spirituality, we have to fight our tradition. So a tradition has built into it the thing against which we have to fight. So traditions have struggle built right into them. They have their own self-protective mechanisms built in, but they also have their own strip us down so that we can then once again be built back up dynamic inside of them. What makes a tradition is that it has all the essential ingredients to take us into this direct encounter, including the cocoon in which we are nurtured and grown and which we have to fight against in order to break out, in order to develop the wings that enable us to fly. There is a darkness built into a tradition that makes us yearn for the light. And there is an institutional safety that nurtures us until we're strong enough to launch out on the quest, our quest for the personal experience of divine light and divine life. When an late adolescent is railing against his or her parents, we know that it is psychologically important for them to be able to think that their parents are idiots. Because in the process of thinking that their parents are idiots, they are finding their own voice, and they're finding their own authority, and they're finding their adult center, and hopefully we can have enough grace and patience for them to get through this really unpleasant stage. But when they do, or if they ever do, come back to their senses, they eventually realize that the family system that they railed against was the same system that fed them and nurtured them and clothed them. It was the same system that gave them the psychological and emotional strength that they needed to stand up and fight for their own autonomy, to fight for their own adult voice, and to break away to become their own person. That's what makes a tradition a tradition. It gives us an institution that nurtures us, that tells us the rules. It tells us what to do, and it tells us when to do it. It tells us what's right, and it tells us what's wrong. And it gets us practicing the virtue curriculum, and it gets us doing the right stuff and saying the right words and making the right motions for long enough for us to get strong enough to be able to break from the institution and to seek our own divine encounter. The tradition, again, gives access to darkness so that we yearn for the light. It gives us access to dryness so that we thirst to find water. And it gives us those security and systems and conventions and policies, all of which give us stability, all of which nurture us until we're strong enough to move forward into our journeys into the contemplative center. And so that burdensome institution, that dumb ox of an institution, that stupid place filled with those stupid people that makes us so mad when they get it so wrong is also the birth canal through which we are born into the experience of divine life. And it is also filled, when we find our way, with nurturing, loving people, many of whom have gone through their own deconstruction journey and are now positioning themselves inside the very institution that they railed against to be there to nurture the next generation, to be the ones who lay out the rules as best they can, who lay out the ancient wisdom as best they can, to give the next generation the best possible chance of finding the divine light and divine life. And yes, the system goes wrong. And yes, we lose our way. But the call that is set before our generation is to find our way again and to make right what has gone wrong, to populate this arduous path to the center, to be there for the well-being of our own souls, to be there for the well-being of those who travel the journey with us, and to be there for the well-being of the generation that follows behind us. This is why a tradition is a tradition. This is why traditions stand the test of time. This is how traditions find their way when they lose their way. So, I stand here in my life contending for the return of the health and well-being of the Christian tradition. And I stand here to populate the journey to the center. And I do it for my own soul's well-being, and I do it for the well-being of those who travel this with me, and for the well-being of those who will come behind me. And I hope that you will stand here with me, a Christian church for the quantum era. So, Spirit of God, for the return of health and well-being to our tradition, we pray. Amen.